Money makes the world go around, the world go around, the world go around. Money makes the world go around, it makes the world go round. A mark, a yen, a buck, or a pound, a buck, or a pound, a buck, or a pound. It's all that makes the world go around. That clinking, clanking sound can make the world go round. Money, 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 money. If you happen to be rich and you feel like a night's entertainment, you can pay for a gay escapade. If you happen to be rich and alone and you need a companion, you ring ting-a-ling for the maid. If you happen to be rich and you find you are left by your lover, though you moan and you groan quite a lot, you can take it on the chin, call a cab, and begin to recover on your 14-carat yacht. Money makes the world go around, the world go around, the world go around. Money makes the world go around. Of that we can be sure. Piss on being poor. Money, 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 money. Money, 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 money. If you haven't any coal in the stove and you freeze in the winter and you curse on the wind at your feet, when you haven't any shoes on your feet and your coat's thin as paper and you look 30 pounds underweight, when you go to get a word of advice from the fat little pester, he will tell you to love evermore. But when hunger comes, rap a rat a tat, rat a tat at the window. See how love flies out the door. For money makes the world go around, the world go around, the world go around. Money makes the world go around. That clinking, clanking sound, it makes the world go around. You know, this week's news has been full of it. Oh, no, not full of that. No, the news is always full of that. I mean, that's hardly worth mentioning. This week's news has been full of the Greek debt crisis. The money won't be paid back. Whether the money was ever owed in the first place is, of course, another matter entirely and not suitable for discussion in polite company. In the news, those horrible Greek people partying away on all those billions or trillions or whatever amount it was, and then not wanting to pay the piper. Shocking. Not in the news. Well, the money owed was pretty much all interest on loans that shouldn't have ever been made in the first place. So, what's it all mean? Well, it means people are getting fed up with big money. Corporations, bankers taking everything. I think it means people are ready to fight back against usurious interest and fake loans. I think it means people are sick of selling their souls so cheaply. I wonder if the USA will take notice of this example and decide that, hey, maybe it wouldn't be so bad to just say the hell with our national debt, too. Wouldn't it be ironic if the non-payment method became the norm? I can tell you one thing for sure. If our government were to default, you and I and the rest of we the people shouldn't expect to see a cent of it. But you could be certain it would be our fault. Oh well. Enough of that. I'm Chuck Gregory. This is the New American Dream Radio Show. And we're streaming live on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. And I am proud now to introduce my friend and co-host, Mike Palachek, an American writer.
Hello, Chuck. Tonight we welcome special guests Richard Flamer, Jim Fetzer, and Susan Lindauer. And so tonight we are joining together for the New American Dream radio show in Fort Lauderdale, Duluth, Madison, Chiapas or Des Moines, Tacoma Park, and wherever you are. My recommendations for this week, Memory Hole blog with recent articles regarding the body of Reverend Pinckney and false terror. Don't forget to read the comments. The Memory Hole blog comment section should be available for postgraduate credit. It's the best education available in the USA. And as always, False Flag Weekly News every Thursday on No Lies Radio with Kevin Barrett and Jim Fetzer. And now, a salute to veterans on International Dead Kid Day. Thank you for all you do for killing 6 million American Indians, for killing 3,000 citizens of Panama in December 1989, just cause, for murdering thousands, millions of people in Iraq, Afghanistan, Yugoslavia, Hiroshima, Nagasaki, Vietnam. You are American-type heroes. You are not insane, psychotic killers who will do whatever anyone tells you to do. You are Americans, through and through. Thank you for all you have done and continue to do. This bud's for you. We also wish to honor liberal filmmaker Michael Moore. His film, Fahrenheit 9/11, was released 11 years ago, June 25th, 2004. Remember all the hoopla around that? We really thought things were happening. They weren't. His film was perhaps the last best shot we had of getting the truth about 9/11 into the mass media, into the minds of Americans, into the history books. Michael Moore. Why didn't you tell the truth about 9/11, that the whole thing was an orchestrated false flag event planned by individuals in the U.S. and Israeli governments? Because you chose not to tell the truth for whatever reason, we honor you today with the FICUS Garden Variety Liberal Potted Plant Award. Michael Moore, you are an American, a powerful American liberal who, like so many others, could tell the truth, could make a difference, change the world, but for whatever reason, just choose to sit there like ficus, the potted plant. Past winners of the Ficus Garden Variety Liberal Potted Plant Award have been Amy Goodman, Matthew Rothschild, Chris Hedges, David Swanson, Bill Moyers, John Stewart, and Stephen Colbert. And now, sponsored by Cheetos, Hostess, Snowballs, Candy Cigarettes, Swanson's TV Dinners, Count Chocula, Ding Dongs, Boston Baked Beans, and Chicken in a Biscuit, another episode of The Elephant in the Room, Memoirs of a Fat Midwest Kid Visiting Relatives at Thanksgiving in the Time of Swine Flu. It was the earliest of times. It was the latest of times. They always got there way too early, while people were still in their pajamas, having coffee, just putting the turkey in the oven. But still, way too late in the day to make any difference, to really affect the lives of the people, his relatives. These people are stupid. I will eat and disappear, thought the elephant in the room. Wait, that plan is not working. I am not disappearing. I am getting larger and larger. I must have a new plan. He sat in the chair in the corner and stared without blinking while his relatives talked all around him. I will run for office. I will write a book. I will break the law. I am not crazy. They are. He smiled, but not really so much as you would notice it. Stay tuned next week for another exciting episode of The Elephant in the Room, Memoirs of a Fat Midwest Kid Visiting Relatives at Thanksgiving in the Time of Swine Flu. Sponsored by Cheetos, Hostess Snowballs, Candy Cigarettes, Swanson TV Dinners, Count Chocula, Ding Dongs, Boston Baked Beans, and Chicken in a Biscuit. And we also want to preview an upcoming summer replacement series set to premiere soon on CBS. Really? Seriously? So these people being grounded on YouTube with these high-production, multi-angle shots, really? Seriously? So remember the endless videos of Osama bin Laden saying new threatening stuff, the videos always found in some FBI agent's grandma's garage, every damn time. Really? Seriously? So remember how we were supposed to be afraid of communists, and then it was criminals, and then it was Big B's, then Motley Crue, then Marilyn Manson, then Al-Qaeda, and now ISIS? So really? Seriously? The new primetime hit TV show coming to you this fall on CBS.
And now for the sports report. We continue our coverage of the Florence, Colorado Supermax Federal Penitentiary Summer Softball League. The league recently completed its annual July 4th round robin tournament. In the semifinals, it was the MK Ultras facing off against the Witness Protection Orange Ghosts. The Orange Ghosts put up a fight in the third inning. Thane Eugene Caesar got on with a sharp single. After Charlie Hebdo bunted Caesar over to second and Charlie Hebdo struck out, the The Ghost, followed with three straight doubles by Barbara Olson, Timothy McVeigh, and Dawn Hochsprung. Clementa Pinckney popped up to shortstop to end the rally, however. The Ultras came through in the final inning on a sacrifice fly by Captain Mark David Chapman, scoring Sirhan Sirhan from third base. That pitted the MK Ultras against the Crisis Actors and Captain H. Wayne Carver in the finals. Coming through for the Crisis Actors in the final ball game were Adam Lanza, Muhammad Atta, Robbie Parker, and Gene Rosen, who all had big games, but still not enough to overcome the powerhouse Ultras, who are led by Terry Nichols, Dylan Stormroof, and James Holmes, who all had clutch games at bat and in the field, even though Holmes had to leave the game in the third inning with an upper ankle sprain. And now for the science report. It's time once again for the adventures of Buzz the Space Dog, sponsored by General Mills Pepperoni Pizza and a toothpaste tube. It's not bad, and if you don't eat something, you'll die. General Mills Pepperoni Pizza and a toothpaste tube. We've heard all about the Russian space monkeys who went into outer space and didn't come back until the Soviet Union was gone. And then when they did come back, they were expecting maybe a parade or a nice DACA out on Taiga View Lane. But that didn't happen. Well, the Americans had their own space dog program going, trying to match the Russians with similar results. When those dogs returned from having been sent up by President John F. Kennedy and splashing down after November 22, 1963, the world they returned to was barely recognizable with Lyndon Johnson in the White House. Some of those dogs took the option of shooting right back out to space. Some moved to Ukiah. Some lived on the streets for years and years in order to ditch anyone who might be tailing them. And then raced to dig up the money buried in the backyard and moved to Edina. And one of those was Buzz. The Adventures of Buzz the Space Dog is also sponsored this evening by the Stanley Kubrick Estate, Rocks R Us Moon Rock Plastic Toys, and Under the Big Top Indoor Movie Lighting Systems.
When we last left Buzz, he had just received a certified letter hand-delivered by an unnamed new male person packing Pomeranian spray. Buzz pinned the envelope to the floor with his paws and ripped it open. It was from one of his old space pals, Neil, the space poodle. A real lapdog's lapdog, Neil was. Uh-oh, he sniffed the letter closely. The letter was supposed to have been delivered days ago. Neil would be here today. Oh, crap, thought Buzz, and he pooped on the carpet and sniffed it. Neil was a big shot. He had actually been to the moon. Buzz was only a test dog, just Earth orbit stuff. They didn't have the technology then. Computers were as big as whole rooms then. The radiation belt, getting by your machine, all that came much later. Buzz hurried around, dusting, straightening, making the house look presentable. He pulled out all his slick moon photos and his moon rocks and set them on the kitchen table, along with an excellent Eau de Toilette 1969 Apollo 11.
Buzz sat in a chair with his nose looking out the front window. A long black limousine pulled up right up to Buzz's front walk. The driver opened the door and out walked Neil, the stately poodle, still with so much style and class and pizzazz. When the bell rang, Buzz was right there, but he willed himself to wait to 1002 and then nosed open the door. Buzz took Neil's hat, collar, whistle, and muzzle. He gave him the tour, and then they hopped up to the kitchen table to settle in. Buzz poured the toilet water into the bowls and pushed over the kibble with his nose. They talked about cats and birds and people and balls for a while, then sticks. Said Buzz. Been meaning to ask you. He put one foot up on the table to drag the photos over closer. These moon pictures. He could sense that Neo was already getting tense. His ears were pointy and his fur bristling. They almost looked like they were done in a studio. At least to me. The lunar lander thing. There's no dust underneath it. And wouldn't there be? Then Buzz nosed the moon rock over where they could both see it up close. How do we know this is a real moon rock? And not just something, well, Buzz pointed with his nose toward the backyard. I've seen lots of these out there. How do we, you know? Neil growled and showed his fangs. He stood, curled his tail between his legs. Buzz pushed the rock closer, got the other photo in his teeth that Neil was supposed to have taken of the other dog with the perfect reflection in the face shield that seemed kind of improbable. Tossed it down in front of Neil. Neil nipped it. Neil bit Buzz right on the paw and then hopped down with his nose in the air, trotted over to stand in front of the front door. The driver opened it. Neil pranced down to the limo and stood by the back door until his driver came and opened that. Buzz stood in the open doorway, watched them leave. Buzz saw himself, just a reflection, in the darkened windows of the limousine as they pulled away.
Stay tuned next week for another adventure of Buzz the Space Dog, when we will see Buzz ask himself yet again, what was that? Thinking he might have heard something and then admonishing himself. Nobody else heard it, he said. I must be going crazy. Or maybe it's Hauenheimer's. I wonder where I put that dog ears conversion card that came in the Alpo bag. Our first guest of the evening is Richard Flamer. Richard Flamer comes to us each month, and he and his wife live at the Chiapas Catholic Worker in Chiapas, Mexico, but I believe he's still up here in Iowa for the better part of the summer, and we'll have Richard on the phone right about now.
Actually, Mike, he told me he's in Kansas City right now.
Oh, is he? Okay.
Get around.
Hello, Chuck.
Hello, Richard. Welcome to the show. You're on.
Thanks. As this airs, I'm on the road driving back to Chiapas and my home near San Cristobal de las Casas in Mexico. 3,150 miles is the trek. While in Des Moines, I managed to work at construction sufficient to buy an older pickup truck and get all the kinks out of the systems, some new brakes and fixing and repairing a bunch of little things. I got to meet with various contractors and handymen and collected a great variety of good usable tools, which I am carrying to be used in a wood shop for young people in Guatemala. The shop has some major tools like a table saw, planer, and a bandsaw, but lacks all of the basic hand tools like hammers, drills, levels, etc. I also got to meet with two different churches, and I was able to obtain a couple of scholarships for 2 to 4 young people from Yalambajos, this little Guatemalan village, to go to a carpentry school in nearby San Cristobal for a 2-year program. Well, Araceli, my wife of 11 years, under Mexican law, was here, we managed to arrange a bilingual marriage ceremony at Trinity United Methodist Church. The wedding was a great success, and we finally got to marry in a church. In Mexico, a civil ceremony is required before any religious ceremony can take place. Additionally, the Immigration Service here in the U.S. is sometimes reluctant to see a Mexican ceremony as valid. The wedding was informal and fantastic. Prior to the ceremony, I printed and passed out flyers with announcements in both Spanish and English at all the places Araceli and I hang out in Des Moines. We passed out flyers to the homeless. We passed out flyers at the food pantry. We passed out flyers in Araceli's English class. In the end, I managed to pass out all of the 100 flyers. The church was full on June 28th with some some coming just for the church service, while others came only for the wedding, which followed. After the wedding, a fine potluck was served with a wonderful homemade cake made by Maria, wife of one of the pastors, Alejandro. On the Tuesday following, the 30th, Araceli flew home, and I headed over to Omaha to stay with friends. My time in Omaha was filled with work as well. I had built a railing and steps for a deck. I installed a 100-amp entrance for an apartment and did endless small jobs with an old friend. By the 4th of July, I was finished with work, and so I stayed around for a picnic party with old friends. On the 5th, I went back to Des Moines to pick up the last of the tools, get some work done on the truck, say goodbye to old friends, and return to Omaha to pack and leave for the road. Today, I'm in Kansas City, where I stopped for the night, last night and tomorrow and tonight, at the home of a close cousin. She's a wonderful, strong woman who has a bad heart and is waiting on a transplant. So I never know if I'm going to see her again, since I only get up to the States every couple of years now. But it's wonderful to stay and stop and visit and chat about family and friends. And from here, I take off tomorrow morning for San Antonio, where I'll meet up with another old buddy, work on rebuilding his bathroom, probably spend a week there. And then from there, head on down to Brownsville and Matamoros and back to Chiapas from there. The reflections when I'm on the road as I'm driving are just myriad. I just have this wonderful quantity of memories, but also thinking about the people that I've met on this trip, but also on other trips. And tools, that's been a lot on my mind. Buckminster Fuller once said that the real wealth of a country is in its ability to make tools. My father used to say that to have tools and not use them was a sin, for others could make a living from those tools. With my truck filled with tools, I'd probably be able to put 12 to 16 young people to work and possibly give them a vocation. So for me, the tools are pretty important. This trip, I've managed to make friends with some new people that I hadn't known before. Eric, a man who owns a roofing company in Des Moines, was so generous, not only with his time, but taking me over to his company and letting me paw through his tools and take quite a number, actually, a joiner and some radial arm saw and a number of tools, which he doesn't use anymore. And I'm always surprised at the generosity and the goodness of the people that I meet along the way. Folks were just wonderful at the wedding. And even though I said that we really didn't want any gifts, we ended up getting money from all sorts of people, including a homeless man who came and gave me $5. He said he'd cut a couple of lawns that day, wanted to make sure that we got a good start on our wedding. It just thrills me to find the goodness in all those people around me, no matter where I am. And I feel particularly blessed to have been able to be on this trip and to have my wife here. We also made contact this trip with an immigration lawyer who happened to be an old friend, and she's since gone back to law school and become an immigration lawyer. So she tells me that we need to fill out 11 forms for immigration, and that Araceli, my wife, needs to be up here for 6 months at a time for a resident alien card. So we have lots of thinking to do and lots of planning to decide if she's going to become a resident alien in the U.S. not permanently, but if she gets the card, then she could work and she could come and go as she pleased. So we're probably going to do something like that. But in the meantime, we just have such a wonderful relationship with the people at the Des Moines Catholic Worker, but also the people at my church and Holy Family in Omaha, who once again are doing just a great job with the poor there. I wanted to thank everybody along the way who helped us out. It really is a great blessing, and we've been so fortunate to find such generous people. Now I just have to go back and get back to work. I'm looking forward to it, and I, of course, miss my friends down there, and now that my wife's back there, I have even more reason to get back as soon as possible. But we'll just see, and I'll have to go through, of course, all the problems at the border and all the rest of it, but somehow they don't seem to be so enormous anymore since I've been doing it for 9 to 20 years now. So that's what I'm up to. And
Richard, sounds fascinating, and congratulations.
Oh, thanks. I wanted to add that we're still taking checks and money orders at Holy Family Catholic Church. They should be made out to the Chiapas Project, care of Holy Family Catholic Church, 1710 Izzard Street, that's Izard Street, Omaha, Nebraska, 68102. And we soon will have the website up at thechiapasproject.com, which will have a PayPal account so we can make deposits that way as well. That's the other thing. When I was up there, I made arrangements with a friend of mine who's working on a website, and I have thousands of photographs, which he's starting to put on, and we're starting to label, and we will end up having several projects and pages on the various projects that we've done in the past, but also what we're working on now. Should be interesting. Chuck, goodbye and God bless.
And now for another episode of On Babushka Kalashnikov's Corner, The View from My Piroshki Cart. Grandma Kalashnikov writes on her website her most recent column, Get Used to It and Live Your Life. Lots of Americans are extremely upset about ISIS. They're not sleeping well and they're pacing the floors. They are convinced that ISIS is coming to get them, drag them from their homes, cart them away to some Arabian desert and behead them. There is something important to keep in mind about all of this. This is the way of life under an empire, especially one whose foreign policy is based on hundreds of military bases in foreign countries, meddling in the political and economic affairs of other countries, support of and partnerships with foreign dictatorships, foreign aid, invasions, war of aggression, occupations, kidnappings, torture, and other such things. Once you realize that chaos, crisis, conflicts, tensions, and wars are an inherent part of imperial life, you don't tend to get so upset over the latest crisis. You instead say to yourself, well, here we go again. Another official enemy who is the gravest threat to national security in the history of the national security state apparatus that was grafted onto our governmental system after World War II. Think about all the official enemies that have scared the dickens out of the American people since the advent of the national security state. Older Americans will attest to the great fear that was inculcated into their generations, the fear that the communists, especially the Soviet Union, but also Red China, were coming to get them, or even worse, that they were going to unleash a nuclear war against the United States. Throughout the Cold War, American life was geared to fearing the communists and ferreting them out. The FBI and the CIA in particular did everything they could to discover subversives within American society, that is, people who were suspected of being communist moles infiltrating America with the aim of turning the country red. That's what the secret FBI campaign against Martin Luther King was all about. It was also what the CIA's secret campaign against the U.S. Communist Party, the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, and opponents of the Vietnam War was all about. It was all driven by fear, which is always the coin of the realm for an empire. If they don't make the people afraid, then people are less likely to go along with the schemes. When the Cold War finally ended, ironically, it was the national security establishment that became fearful. They feared that Americans might say that since the national security apparatus, including the enormous military establishment and the CIA, had come into existence to wage the Cold War, then why not now abolish this apparatus now that the Cold War was over? After all, most everyone understood that the national security state apparatus was alien to America's heritage of anti-militarism, anti-imperialism, and non-intervention. That's certainly what President Eisenhower said in his farewell address in 1960. U.S. national security state officials didn't have to fear long. Almost immediately, Saddam Hussein was made the new official boogeyman. He was the new Hitler. He was going to conquer the world. Even worse, he was going to unleash mushroom clouds over American cities with WMDs. Ironically, before he was converted into a new official enemy, Saddam had been a partner of the U.S. national security establishment. In fact, I'll bet that lots of Americans don't know that Saddam got those scary WMDs from the U.S. and other Western nations when he was their friend and partner. But throughout the 90s, no one thought about the partnership between Saddam and the U.S. government. That was kaput. All that mattered now was that a people now had a deep fear of a new official enemy, Saddam Hussein, a fear that gripped their minds for more than a decade. After Iraq was conquered, the fear of Saddam was replaced by the fear of Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda, who now supposedly posed a greater threat to the U.S. than even the communists and Saddam. The 9/11 attacks confirmed that the terrorists were definitely coming to get us and even take control of the federal government, including the IRS, DEA, Federal Reserve, and other federal agencies. Today, people tend to forget the deep fear that they had of al-Qaeda. But it was as great as their fear of ISIS and, for that matter, of the communists and Saddam Hussein. Today, it's ISIS. What matters is that it is a new official enemy that everyone is supposed to fear. After all, who knows? ISIS might have Saddam's WMD secretly hidden in some desert or cave in Iraq or Syria. This is what empire is all about, constant, perpetual fear. And who is the big winner in all this perpetual chaos, crisis, conflict, war, and fear? You guessed it. The vast military-industrial complex that President Eisenhower warned was a grave threat to your nation. With President Obama announcing that his war against ISIS would last for years, the defense contractors are assured a continuous, ever-growing flow of U.S. taxpayer dollars into their coffers. And don't think that it's only going to last a few years, because you can rest assured that a new official enemy will pop up somewhere to justify a perpetual flow of money into the military-industrial complex. Oh, by the way, have you noticed that the same phenomenon of perpetual crisis, chaos, and fear also pervades the war on drugs and the war on immigrants and the prison construction boom? You can be fearful and you can pace the floor. But if you want a society of peace, prosperity, and harmony, there is but one solution. Dismantle, don't reform, the vast military empire and national security state apparatus, and end America's foreign policy of intervention. Otherwise, just prepare yourself for a life of perpetual crisis, chaos, war, conflict, and fear. On Babushka Kalashnikov's Corner, sponsored by Powder Milk Piroshki. Heavens, they're tasty and expeditious. And on the other side of the globe, we now get the view from Uncle Bill's front porch. modern propaganda techniques utilized by the corporate state to enforce anti-democratic and destructive policies routinely entail the manufacture and manipulation of news events to mold public opinion and, as Edward Bernays put it, engineer consent towards certain ends. Such events include not only overt political appeals, but also acts of seemingly spontaneous terrorism and militarism that traumatize the body politic into ultimately accepting false narratives as political and historical realities. Western states' development and utilization of propaganda closely parallels the steady decay of political enfranchisement and engagement throughout the 20th century.
Upon securing a second term in 1916, the Democratic administration of Woodrow Wilson plunged the United States into the most violent and homicidal war in human history. Wilson, a former Princeton University academician groomed for public office by Wall Street bankers, assembled a group of progressive left journalists and publicists to sell the war to the American people. George Creel, Walter Lippmann, Edward Bernays, and Harold Laswell all played influential roles in the newly formed Committee on Public Information and would go on to be major figures in political thought, public relations, and psychological warfare research. The sales effort was unparalleled in its scale and sophistication. The CPI was not only able to officially censor news and information, but essentially manufacture them as well, acting in the role of a multifaceted advertising agency. Creel's operation examined the different ways that information flowed to the population and flooded these channels with pro-war material. The committee's domestic organ was comprised of 19 subdivisions, each devoted to a specific type of propaganda, one of which was a division of news that distributed over 6,000 press releases and acted as the chief avenue for war-related information. On an average week, more than 20,000 newspaper columns carried data provided through CPI propaganda. The division of syndicated features enlisted the help of popular novelists, short story writers, and essayists. These mainstream American authors presented the official line in a readily accessible form, reaching 12 million people every month. Similar endeavors existed for cinema, impromptu soapbox oratory, the 4-minute man, and outright advertising at home and abroad.
Any person or organization depends ultimately on public approval, Bernays notes, and is therefore faced with the problem of engineering the public's consent to a program or goal. With the advent of the national security state in 1947, secret programs emerged where the people are, as a matter of course, intentionally left unaware of the state's true rationales and objectives. Indeed, a wealth of contemporary historical examples suggest how the engineering of consent is wholly calculating and anti-democratic.
The U.S. economic provocation of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor and the Tonkin Gulf incident precipitating U.S. military occupation of Vietnam are obvious examples of such manufactured events. Similar techniques are apparent in the major political assassinations of the 1960s, where to this day the public is prompted to partake in the false reality that Lee Harvey Oswald was the sole culprit in the murder of President John F. Kennedy. Sirhan Sirhan was responsible for the death of Senator Robert F. Kennedy. In fact, in each instance, overwhelming evidence points to Central Intelligence Agency involvement in orchestrating the assassinations while training and presenting Oswald and Sirhan as the would-be assassins.
The U.S. government's assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., probably the most influential African-American public persona of the 20th century, is not even open to debate, having been soundly proven in a court of law. Yet, as with the Kennedys, it is a genuine public relations achievement that much of the American population is oblivious to the deeper dynamics of these political slayings that are routinely overlooked or inaccurately recounted in public discourse.
Along these lines, in the historical context of Operation Gladio, the Oklahoma City Murrah federal building bombing, the events of September 11, 2001, the London 7-7-2005 bombings, and lesser episodes, such as the shoe and underwear bombers. The engineering of consent has reached staggering new heights, where state-orchestrated terrorism is used to mold public opinion toward acceptance of militarized policing operations, the continued erosion of civil liberties, and major sustained aggression against moderate Middle Eastern nations to cartelize scarce resources and politically reconfigure an entire region of the world.
Again, the public is essentially compelled to believe that political extremism of one form or another is the cause of each event, even in light of how the sophistication and scope of the Oklahoma City and 9/11 attacks suggest high-level forces at work. If one is to delve beneath the public relations narrative of each event, the Newtown Massacre and Boston Marathon bombing likewise appear to have broader agendas where the public is again purposely misled. Conventional journalists and academics are reluctant to publicly address such phenomena for fear of being called conspiracy theorists.
The achievements of modern public relations are further evident in the Warren and 9/11 commissions themselves, both of which have spun the fantastic myths of Alan Dulles and Peter Zelikow, respectively. And today, they maintain footholds in public discourse and consciousness.
Indeed, the conspiracy theory meme, a propaganda campaign waged by the CIA beginning in the mid-1960s to counter criticism of the Warren Commission report, is perhaps as little known as Operation Mockingbird, the CIA program where hundreds of journalists and publishers actively devoted their services to spread agency disinformation. The overall effect of these combined operations has been an immensely successful program continues to shape the contours of American political life and mediated reality.
The present socio-political condition and suppression of popular democracy are triumphs of modern propaganda technique.
The view from Uncle Bill's front porch, sponsored by homemade apple pie in the bright red can. Our next guest of the evening is Jim Fetzer. Jim Fetzer speaks to us each month from his home in near Madison, Wisconsin. And Chuck will be getting Jim on the phone right
now. Chuck, it's great to be back with you guys again. I've been fascinated to discover that Time magazine, not long ago, offered its list of the top 10 conspiracy theories. And while it was unsurprising to me that JFK was number one, and 9/11 was number two. Number four was already Paul is dead. Number six was the moon landing. Was it faked? And number eight was Holocaust revisionism, which may account for the popularity of our book. And I suppose we didn't go to the moon either, because we are addressing, among its principal objects of discussion, the moon landing, whether Paul McCartney died and was replaced, and of course the Holocaust, and whether it has not been greatly exaggerated. In three different contexts, there's an interesting developments on all three fronts. The first I'll mention has to do with discussion going on in Amazon.com for the book, where the most critical review, a three-star review, where the vast majority are five, has been followed up by two apologists for NASA, in particular a fellow named James Davis, and someone else who calls himself Common Sense. James Davis committed a blunder by ignoring that the moon landing hoax is a subject of refutation that makes a claim that is the equivalent of the conjunction of a whole host of issues, each of which is individually vulnerable to refutation, by maintaining that if the Van Allen belt were not an insuperable obstacle to transiting to the moon, then we had gone to the moon, which was simply an egregious blunder. He referred to the Van Allen belt argument as the foundation for moon hoax theories, but there are, you know, probably 100 other really important and viable objections to be raised here, where I explained that he had misunderstood the difference between confirmation and falsification, which only requires that we show some of the main elements of the moon landing account to be provably false, in that he was mistaking a shotgun for a rifle. Just because one slug of a shotgun misses you doesn't mean, alas, that the rest do as well. But he is, had he put it differently, it's certainly the case that if it's impossible to pass through the Van Allen radiation belt, which was created with the formation of Earth about 4.5 billion years ago, then that's sufficient to show that we did not go to the moon. So that argument, like others, including my relatively recent discovery that the computing capabilities available for the Apollo moon projects was hopelessly inadequate, even appears to have been completely faked, which is one of the more interesting arguments I've introduced into the discussion, and by far the most important that isn't present in the book, the last I looked, because it's a beauty, where Davis sought to respond by saying that there was enough computing capacity to have manless missions to the moon, unmanned missions to the moon, land on the moon and return, which I compared to claiming that if you can win a soapbox derby, then you can win the Indianapolis 500. A hopelessly inadequate claim. Common sense, however, has displayed more, well, let's say common sense, by observing his approach is based on the following reasoning. If the moon landings were a hoax, then you don't only need to prove beyond doubt that one of the hoax claims are correct. In other words, you only need to provide one piece of indisputable evidence of a hoax, evidence that holds up to close scrutiny, evidence that has no other explanation, and in doing so will put a question mark over the validity of the entire Apollo program. Now, he has it right. Davis had it wrong, where I go on to observe in endorsing his conception of the methodology of the argument, the logic or structure of the argument, is why I have made point after point about the Van Allen radiation belt, the incapacity of then available computers to control the mission, photos from the moon showing shadows cast in more than one direction, illumination in the shadow of the lander, moon rover photos with no tracks leading to the lander, to the rover in front of, behind, or in between its wheels, flag waving when there is no atmosphere, rover tracks and footprints in dust with no moisture present, on and on and on, where I am presently engaged in discussion with him about the waving flag on the surface of the moon, which Davis has claimed was caused by turning the pole by astronauts, the origin of gamma radiation, especially in relation to Apollo 16, which was accompanied by some historic solar flares, and the presence of rover tracks as recorded by the moon orbiter, which Gerald White has studied. So for those of you who are interested in the current state of our debate, at least in relation to the book, I recommend you go online to the, you know, and I suppose we didn't go to the moon either, and the discussion that's now extended over 90 comments altogether, and perhaps you'll find something worth commenting on yourself. Very interesting stuff, and as I've observed in the process, I don't learn from those who agree with me, but rather from my critics. So, you know, it's an excellent exercise. And these guys, as David Percy, who is an expert on the Apollo moon program, just won't quit. Others offer their explanation for why that's the case. But it's very obvious that if NASA were to acknowledge that the moon landing program was a hoax, that the American people would lose confidence in their government. A very fascinating development has come from Norway, where Paul McCartney, that is to say, the man who goes by that name now, the man who was knighted by the Queen, Sir Paul, performed at a conference on the 4th of July, and where several articles were published about it, including one entitled, Did the Wrong McCartney Show Up? Another Scandal, The Fake McCartney. And I'd like to read a little from a translation I've been sent of one of these articles, where Nick Kullerstrom and I discussed this on The Real Deal just last night. So if you can find our latest, you know, episode where Nick and I talk about Paul Fall, but also about 7/7, the London bombings, on which Nick is the leading expert in the world, I think you'll find this rather fascinating. Here I will read from this translation. Scandal, the wrong McCartney. Harmless doppelganger stole the show from the legend who only appeared in glimpses. Contrary to everyone else, Paul McCartney did not have to show ID to enter the festival. This turned out to be a fatal mistake. Instead of the icon from the Beatles, a wax figure for Madame Tussauds sneaked up on the orange stage Saturday night and acted out a pretty weak forgery of the festival's uncontested lead name. At least this is how it looked during most of the marathon concert's 2 hours and 38 minutes. The real Sir Paul, whom we actually love because of all the old classics from before the first Roskilde Festival 1971, only appeared in glimpses. Maybe the veteran at the age of 73 has become too old to stand and sit on a stage for that long, and I can testify to the fact that he was not the only one who had problems staying awake until 04:30 in the morning, when golden slumbers put an appropriate end to the boredom. It all started at 22:05 p.m., which of course is 10:05 p.m., with an amateurish version of Magical Mystery Tour, which left considerably more disappointment than magic hanging in the air in the beautiful Danish summer night. The song set the tone for a seance where McCartney's unmatched song treasure was left dull and sad in the dust of Zealand, the Danish island of Ceylon, which is directly translated as Soul Land.
Thanks, Jim. We're sorry the end of that got cut off, but we'll see you again next time.
Coming in the fall on TV-ish, the new reality show premiering this fall on NBC, where contestants will be abandoned on a secluded island with only one fishing line, and in order to be given hooks, bait, and minnow buckets, will be asked to guess the number of years penalty for war crimes that certain people will get after the new American Revolution. As with Jeopardy, which has its set ways where contestants have to form their answers in the form of a question, ish contestants will always have to say ish at the end of their answers. Such as, for example, this example. How many years will former President George W. Bush be in Leavenworth or Attica or Lewisburg or Terre Haute for his role in 9/11 after the new American Revolution? And then Marie Ann from Boise says, 34 years. I mean, 34-ish, something like that. Ish. Look for it in the fall. Sponsored by Slippery Slope Jail Soap on a Rope. Occupy Dealey Plaza, that's where it all began. November 22nd, 1963, about 12:30 p.m. 52 years ago, this year, on November 22nd, 2015, filled Dealey Plaza with protesters and signs and singing and speaking and let them bring their dogs and their cops and their robbers and murderers and their sniper rifles and double secret video cameras and microphones. Occupy Dealey Plaza. We demand a truth commission to replace the Warren Commission and the 9/11 Commission. We want freedom. We want peace. We want real hope and real change. Occupy Dealey Plaza. Let them know we know what they have done. Occupy Dealey Plaza. Let the world know this is America. And now a word from the New American Dream Language Corner. Many military terms are in everyday usage, like good to go. Then there is a cup of Joe, so named because Secretary of the Navy Josephus Daniels took away the alcohol aboard ships, replacing it with coffee. And now we have threw under the bus, such as the American government threw the American people under the bus, and the American military threw the American people under the bus, and the CIA threw the American people under the bus. A word from the New American Dream Language Corner.
I'm mad as hell. I'm not going to take it anymore. Hello, everyone. Now for your local Earth news. This is Chuck Gregory and Mike Palachek with a review of today's news from the eye of the hurricane and the eye of the blizzard. Obama at the Pentagon, no end to ISIS war. The U.S. government will continue its military intervention in Iraq and Syria indefinitely while ramping up its counterterrorism operations, both overseas and within the U.S. President Barack Obama made this clear in public remarks at the Pentagon Monday. Flanked by a phalanx of military officials and commanders, Obama outlined a perspective of endless war in Iraq, Syria, and beyond in a speech delivered after closed-door meetings with top military officials.
Nearly a year after its launch, Operation Inherent Resolve, originally presented to the American people as a temporary and limited action, has become an open-ended war stretching across large parts of Iraq and Syria. The Iraq-Syria war, which has already involved some 5,000 combat sorties by U.S. and allied warplanes and return to Iraq of thousands of U.S. troops, is part of what Obama called a generational struggle against violent extremism to be waged without any timetable or geographical limitation. This will not be quick. This is a long-term campaign, Obama said. Obama's remarks came in the immediate wake of some of the most intense bombing of the entire campaign, with U.S. and allied warplanes launching some 40 strikes against targets throughout the Iraq-Syria war theater over the weekend. Rather than attempt a legal justification for the war, which has been launched and prosecuted behind the backs of the American people in defiance of popular opposition, Obama defended his administration's war policies by boasting of the large kill count achieved by the U.S.-led coalition. It's important to recognize the progress that's been made. We've eliminated thousands of fighters, Obama said, underscoring the fact that it has become routine for the president to speak of killing or taking out people around the world. Obama devoted nearly half of his remarks to what he called the fight against terror threats within the United States. He said ominously that his administration was partnering with Muslim communities in the U.S. and added that we expect those communities to step up. This was a thinly veiled justification for continuing government surveillance of the American people and other repressive measures carried out under the pretext of protecting the homeland. His remarks followed days of media scaremongering leading up to the Independence Day holiday on July 4th. For several days, the networks led their news broadcasts with alarming reports of heightened terror threats without producing a shred of evidence to substantiate their warnings while acknowledging that the government had not detected any credible specific threats. Obama's emphasis on the war on terror at home made clear that the relentless campaign of the government to sow fear and anxiety among the public in order to justify internal repression and external military aggression would continue unabated.
And now we hear from our panel of experts, belly up at the bar at Joe's Place in Sandusky, Ohio, who just watched President Obama speak on the TV up in the corner.
There's no end to Obama's bull. I don't know how people can watch Fox or CNN anymore or any mainstream TV news. It's just crap. The scaremongering is off the chart. It's hard to see how any sane human being could say the words uttered by Obama. Orwell is turning over in his grave. Do military industrial powerheads have a gun to his head, perhaps threatening to launch a nuclear holocaust if Obama stops facilitating carnage throughout the rest of the world? These wars is a wet dream of the military industrial core. Just can't get better than that. This is what this low life called change. None of this is enough for these bloodthirsty psychopaths now want Iran's blood, all based on lies. Most thought that Hitler was horrible. What you call this 13 years war and continues, but the mass Americans are broke. Don't worry, it's for the people, by the people. They are all just jealous of our way of life. Praise God that after all, we are a God-fearing nation. Really? I can't believe how low we have sunk, and for sure that the evil rules our country.
But I think even if U.S. bombs to death even 2 million Syrians and Iraqis, it's not going to achieve its final solution for the region. That's not the reason. The reason is that the war factors are working 24 hours, 7 days a week. That's the most important fact. Obama sleeps and smiles, and he's so proud of his nasty self.
As that great American hero Bugs Bunny would say, what a maroon, President Whack-A-Mole. You recall much of progressive media censored and lied about how the Syria war got started. Pacifica, NPR, KBOO, Common Dreams, Amy Goodman, Chomsky, Al Jazeera, Human Rights Watch, Amnesty, all lie for U.S. imperialism. That's all, folks. That's the news, and we are out of here. Good night and good luck. And so it goes. That's the way it is. Stay on the same page. Take it to the next level. It is what it is. At the end of the day, have a good day. And remember that you can start the revolution today by making direct eye contact with any policeman. Our next guest of the evening is Susan Lindauer. Susan Lindauer speaks to us each month from Tacoma Park, Maryland. Susan is an author and activist. She has her own radio show. And we tried to get her that last week, but she had phone problems. And we are looking forward, last month, I mean, we're really looking forward to talking to Susan this month.
Hello.
Well, hello, Susan. It's Chuck and Mike and the New American Dream Radio Show, and you're on the air.
Thank you so much. Hey, everybody. It's Susan Lindauer tonight. I'm sure like all of you, kind of disgusted and enraged by the phony, well, perhaps the Greeks don't see it as phony. It's unfortunate that it's happening, but the IMF austerity demands on the Greek people, and the phony concern by the banksters that if Greece doesn't pay, the whole banking establishment will collapse down on top of the world. Because, in fact, we now know billion, or maybe it's 53 billion euros. In exchange for that, they have already had to agree to have sales tax hikes and cuts in state pensions, cuts in pensions for senior citizens. So they've made some pretty serious changes to their government. But what is most alarming is that this, it's 53 billion euros and 59 billion U.S. dollars. This money does not go to the people at all. It only goes straight to probably 80 or 85% of it goes straight to the banks for the interest payments. So what's happening is that Greece is being forced to borrow money to pay for the banks that have made these ridiculous loans that they're not capable of paying back ever. And then they're being forced to borrow money rather than just have a one-time cut and just cut the debt and eliminate the debt which would be the easiest and which would actually save the country and save the Eurozone and save all the other countries as well. But the problem that they're having is that the banks are afraid that if they cut the $245 billion debt that Greece has taken on, and again, most of this comes, the $245 billion debt does not come from running the country, it comes from paying the bankers. But if they cut the $245 billion debt for Greece, then Spain will be right behind them, Portugal will be right behind them, Italy, France, and on and on and on. What we see, of course, in Iceland is that when Iceland decided, they cast a referendum and said, well, we're not going to pay this back. This is ridiculous. We refuse to borrow. We to foist this usury upon us, because it's only multiplying something that we could take a different model and cut it out entirely. And that's the Iceland model, which is to just say, instead of borrowing to pay this particular debt, we're going to shave it off. And it works just as well, and Iceland is going to be better off for it. If you want to know what IMF austerity means, look to the society. You've only to look at Latin America. And, of course, the Europeans were quite happy to impose IMF austerity, which resulted in vast unemployment, deep impoverishment. The intellectual class had to leave the region. The educated people had to go somewhere else to get jobs, because even having an engineering degree wasn't enough to find employment. So they couldn't. They lost skills. And then there was a massive migration out of the society, which is pretty much what we're going to be seeing here too. Anyone who's got any skill capabilities, any talent, will be forced out of the society. And so we are now a world in motion, whether it's war in the Middle East, whether it's European austerity, because this problem is all through the country, all through the continent. Europe is on the verge of collapse, or it could be saved. But we cannot allow our world to be held hostage by these banksters, which is, of course, what all of us say. And all, I know I'm preaching to the choir here. All of us know that the banksters can't, you know, that we cannot let the banksters run our societies and cannot make the decisions of our government. But we're now, you know, but a lot of people are still thinking, just like the Europeans thought, oh, it's only Latin America, it's those fools over there, they're primitive, they're backwards, they're third world, they're far away. Now they're discovering that it's hitting close to home. And if that sounds condescending, it is condescending. But Americans are just as guilty, and we see this as happening to the Europeans, and not recognizing that it's very soon going to happen to us. And we are far more addicted to government greed, government spending, than any other country on the earth. And we have less to show for it. At least the Greeks do give their people pensions. We don't even do that. At least the Greeks provide medical care for their people. We don't do that. We don't provide university educations to those who are worthy of, who can benefit from it and prove that they have the scholastic capability to be achievers. We don't do that. Yet we have the greatest government spending per capita globally, and it's all going to corporate welfare and corporate socialism among the people who don't want to pay taxes, who resent most that they should have to give anything to the society that we live in, but they wish to receive the benefits of it. And those are the one percenters, and especially the defense contractors. I resent calling them military people, because It's not for the military. We're cutting 40,000 soldiers because we don't need them. Let's be honest. We don't need these people anymore. We're not fighting the unnecessary wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And we're at a stage where we're always able to cut soldiers. We're always able to give soldiers very little money. We're always satisfied. You know, we raise the flag and we call ourselves patriots and we abuse the military symbol, just like George Bush going to these fundraising events for wounded soldiers and then congratulating his administration. We are a socialist state, not because we're giving money to the people, but because we are endlessly feeding the corporations who don't want to pay any taxes. And they are the beneficiaries of all of this money. They are the largesse, and they're sinking us. We are now, those of you, let's not forget that 6 months ago, in December of, when Congress passed the new budget for 2015, they included provisions that banks could now have bail-ins and could seize deposits of American consumers, you know, American account holders, in order to pay for derivatives debt or to pay for any other debts that the banks might incur. And this is now part of the law. And all of the European countries are in the European Union are being required to pass the same legislation allowing bail-ins to occur if the banks desire it. It doesn't even have to be a government policy. The banks will do it themselves. And so we're in quite a state here. And I think we should all stop pretending that Greece is somehow different than us. We have a serious problem in terms of identifying which side the bankers are on, and they're certainly not on our side. So, everyone, I hope you will have. I don't know if my time is up or not.
I think you have about another 3 to 4 minutes.
Okay, great. But think about this. Greece has. Greece is a small country with a debt of $245 billion on it. And that's because of, this is the consequence of the bank bailouts in 2010 and 2012. And so we have made these bailouts the solution to the problem, when in fact the better solution would be to cut the interest and cut out the interest payment, because that's just profits for the bank. You know, even if you just cut the interest out entirely and just went to the original monies that the bank, that the Greeks borrowed and said, okay, you won't have to pay any interest on this. You're just going to pay the real money that you borrowed. So if you borrowed $50 billion, you're not going to pay any interest payments on that. You're just going to repay the exact money that you borrowed with nothing else on top of it. So the profits for the bank will be severely curtailed, but at least the underlying principal will be paid. It's the difference of paying for your house, you know, once versus paying for it 5 times with interest over 30 years. And of course, it's much easier to do the first than the latter. And this is a moment where we, all of us together, have got to decide that we're going to go after the bankers, and we're not going to let them manipulate us into being so fearful that we presume that their profits are worthy of destroying our societies, or that if they don't get their profits of 15%, if they're only paid the original debt without all this compounded interest, that the world is going to collapse under all of us. Quite the opposite is going to happen. We can fix this, but we have to start taking back our power, and we'd better do it now, because today it's Greece, but in 6 months or a year, by the, you know, in the next 12 months, it's going to be us too. This is not going to continue. China is no longer able to buy U.S. debt. Luxembourg, which bought a lot of debt in 2013, that's over. 2013, 2014, that buying spree is over. And we're now at a phase where we're going to have to live on whatever we can generate in taxes, and we're going to have to cut our lifeline, our dependency on corporate welfare and our dependency on corporate socialism way back. So thank you very much, everybody.
Thank you, Susan. That was very informative and well-informed.
Well, thank you very much. I know everybody has an opinion on Greece right now, and I know I'm preaching to the choir about the bankers, but we've got to get, we all know, all of us listening to these radio shows, we know that we've got to make some hard choices now. We've got to make some decisions as to how much power we're going to give these people. But is it really so terrible? If a man loans you $5,000, does he really need to be repaid $20,000? Is that, you think about how silly that is. It's just like if you buy a house for $100,000 and you end up paying $400,000 back and you can't make the $400,000 in payments, so you lose your house. Is that really desirable for society? Is that really necessary to have all of this compounded interest? And if the banks don't get their extra $300,000 on your house, have they really lost? Are they really suffering a loss if they only get a little bit of the original monies that they gave you, and maybe a little bit more? And the same thing with Greece. This is just ridiculously silly to say that the banks are going to have to get three times or four times the amount of what they originally gave in principal, and that they need all this compounded interest payments in order to have in order to stay solvent. It's just simply not true. So thank you, everybody.
Thank you, and we'll talk to you next time.
And now for another episode of Just Living the Dream, episodes in the lives of real Americans. We see the Thomas family in the SUV. Mom is driving into the drive-thru and everyone else is watching individual TVs. Mom hollers back asking what everyone wants on their burgers. Nobody answers. Everyone keeps staring at their TVs. The drive-thru lane inches forward. Mom grows increasingly nervous. She hollers louder. The children turn up the volume on the TVs. Mom screams that they are getting dangerously close to the order box. We have to decide. We have to decide. Still no answer. Still no answer. Hello? Tune in next week for another episode of Just Living the Dream, episodes in the lives of real Americans.
And now, we return to the adventures of Mark in his parents' basement, covered in Cheetos dust. He's just had a thought. Wait, here it is. Conspiracy theory equals unspeakable truth. OMG, he whispers to himself. Yes! And shoots a clenched fist into the air. He is conspiracy theory man, the man of La Mancha. Now we hear again from the New American Dream Language Corner. We have developed language over many days to say what is on our mind. It is highly nuanced, all sorts of words, and we need all of them because human beings are complicated and can think and feel to a highly sophisticated degree. And so why is every radio station from Bakersfield to Staten Island the same? Every newspaper from Vancouver Island to Fort Lauderdale the same? Saying the same things. And why is every local television news show the same? All the same. A word from the New American Dream Language Corner.
And now for yet another episode of Just Living the Dream, episodes in the lives of real Americans. In one room, we've got the guys watching the football game after Thanksgiving dinner. In another room, we've got the gals watching Wheel of Fortune. They're all talking about the same things they talked about last year.
One by one, like astronauts lost in space, they lose consciousness from the turkey and the stuffing and the pie and begin to doze. Downstairs and outside, we got the kids shooting each other with toy guns. All the cars parked in the driveway, up and down the street. Gentle seesaw snoring sound can be heard coming from the house. The guys or the gals or the kids don't see the tanks rumbling down their streets, moving toward them, and soldiers and police in full combat gear crouching behind their cars. They don't hear the helicopters overhead or the snipers clanging the swings in the jungle gym. They don't hear the tiny yelp of their dog as a SWAT member slices its throat with a quick practice motion.
Tune in next week for another episode of Just Living the Dream, episodes in the lives of real Americans. And now we return to the adventures of Mark in his parents' basement, covered in Cheetos dust. The man who knew too much, conspiracy theory man, the man of La Mancha, the man in the gray flannel pajama bottoms, Jean Valjean, Robin Hood, Holden Caulfield, Tom Jones, Ishmael, Rabbit Angstrom, George Bailey, Jefferson Smith, Frodo Baggins, Usarian, Harry Potter, Charlie Brown, Calvin and Hobbes, Atticus Finch, Huck Finn, Winston Smith.
Mark, in his parents' basement, covered in Cheetos dust, he who can and will change the world. It is his time. He writes on his blog, Cheetos and moon dust are both orange. This new piece he's just now completing. The weakest link. If Gene Rosen is a fake, then the whole chain breaks. Then we know that the Bush administration did 9/11 themselves. Then we know that Karl Rove and George Bush cheated and Bush was never a real president. Then we know that Dick Cheney and the FBI killed Paul Wellstone. Then we know that Oklahoma City was done by the FBI and the Clinton administration. Then we know that Clinton and Reno burned men, women, and children alive on purpose at Waco. Then we know we never went to the moon. Then we know that the CIA killed John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, and John Jr. If Gene Rosen is a fake, then we know that the FBI killed Martin Luther King Jr. We know that Sandy Hook and Aurora in Boston and a dozen other so-called terror events were fake. The weakest link. If Gene Rosen is a fake, then the whole ugly, rusted, tangled chain breaks.
Mark swipes Cheetos dust from his chest, pushes his glasses up tight to his face, and writes, hard to see, the dark side is. Do or do not. There is no try.
Well, it's been another long week in Newtown, my hometown, at the end of the empire. It's time for the publication of the new sophomore history textbook, the bread and butter of 3B1K Publishing House, managed by Nicostatus Greenberg in Newtown. Seems nobody's paying much attention to history these days. What is he to do? Well, he's running all over town to talk to people to figure things out, for one thing. Good morning, Daisy. Nick yanked open the glass front door, waved to his secretary, keeping far enough away that he could not hear what she said, and she could not reach him with the notes and papers in her hand. She got a shot around desks, tables. Usually Daisy forced herself to be perky as an Iowa dental office. But sometimes she just had to buckle down for both of them. She stalked him between desks and file cabinets like a hummingbird that needed to eat. He kept his heading, at times seeing her hair above cubicles in a perfect line, standing on a chair, down again to meet him at his office door. Which she did. She always did. He paused, turned to Daisy, huffing out of breath. "Yes," he said. She was also fatigued. "You gotta go talk to Martha, Mary," she said. I handed him a neat stack of papers and notes on a single piece of paper with a single stick of juicy fruit. He accepted the stack, dropped it where he stood, and headed off with the gum and the single sheet. Nick headed out the side door to the tower. He walked over the lawn to the tall brick eye, which could have been a smokestack or a Middle Ages missile silo, but was not. It was the font tower. Nick trudged up the circular iron stairs, round and round. Tower top was a wonder to behold, like a lighthouse, and if you were not right here, right now, you would not imagine the big, clear window looking out over the river and the wood floor and wooden work tables and benches where, like monks with their letterpress, Martha and Mary had toiled for decades. Their specialty, their love, their craft, was the Gutenberg font, Old English. Impossible to read, beautiful to look at. The ink smell here was different than other places in the plant, more predominant, organic here, embedded. Like someone had bled ink into the brick and stone. Maybe scented spit. Hello. There they sat as they had for centuries, perhaps, at a giant oak table, hunched over their work with their chisels, wood boxes of wooden letters, composing stick, mallet, neatly stacked on the wooden benches around the room, hot metal, old church bulletins, wedding invitations, greeting cards, poetry books. Nick clutched in his hand the one paper that Daisy had given him that he had kept. The notice that the last customer of Martha and Mary had died. He walked to the old press that required two people to operate, one to work the press, the other to ink the type. That's why Nick's grandfather had asked the two. That was his excuse. He needed two people. Actually, he thought they could protect each other by sitting back to back. Well, you see, it was way back. Back in the days of fast-pitch softball and bowling leagues, when people talked to each other face-to-face, sat on front porch steps and talked to those walking by. It was after World War II. The men were home. Everyone was going to live long, great lives, have fun, play softball, go bowling, have happy children, paint the front fence white. All of that. And Martha and Mary were the two best softball pitchers in town. They were the leaders of the two rival women's athletic teams in town, the Chicklets and the Baby Ruths. They waged low-intensive warfare over the summer on the hot diamond and through the winter in the warm bowling alleys. That lasted for a good long while, but then things started to change. Not so you'd notice. Then all at once. The biggest sign of the change was slow-pitch softball and grammar. The plant had managed an entire grammar department for many years, decades. Then gradually, all of a sudden, it got phased out. It happened largely over which and that a great controversy inside the walls of the plant that spread to the town and threatened to burn it down. People arguing about which or that. Martha and Mary, both being lively, educated young women, knew that which was sometimes better used over that, such as you use that before a restrictive clause and which before everything else. Some argued that it was more than that, more complex. The battle raged, and finally, Martha and Mary were the only ones on the side of reason. They were hunted down, stalked, stared at. People burned, which, in their front lawns. People wore white t-shirts with that in big bold letters. Martha and Mary fought this battle at the same time as they battled each other on the diamond and the alleys. They kept at it for as long as they could, the softball and bowling, long after the which that war was forgotten, into the Carter administration even, until the Chicklets and the Baby Ruths were the only teams left in town. The bowling leagues faded out as well, so gradually that you really didn't notice, but one day they were just not there, leaving Mary and Martha standing on opposite sides of the ball return. Some say Mary made the first move, some Martha. But they ended up drying their hands from the same alley and have ever since. In the meantime, the Moose Lodge opened itself to the public and served walleye every Friday for $5, all you can eat, just to keep the doors open. Nobody joined the clubs anymore. Neighbors did not go for walks to talk to other neighbors sitting on front porches. They locked their doors and huddled close to the television. And for a while they, Martha and Mary, barnstormed the country, playing games against American Legion high school players using just themselves and a catcher. When Nick's grandfather found them, they were sitting on the third baseline bench at the old softball stadium. Just sitting. His tee shot from the ninth had drifted again. He walked up to them, remembering how they were always together, and there was one of them who was a bit famous in town for being able to calculate pretty accurately how much any amount of rain would equal in snow inches. And he asked if they would come work for him. Grandpa Greenberg had always wanted to use the tower for something other than to store the old chairs confiscated from the middle school for the district not being able to pay the textbook bill. And so he set Martha and Mary up as typesetters of the very old style, a side job, job printing, they called it. Turned out perfect, as if it were what they were meant to do. Their hands were strong as iron from bowling and pitching. And well, with the things they could make a softball and bowling ball do, magical things, people called them both the witches of the woods. Maybe they'd be able to use their mystical monk-like magic to watch over the company in the town from up there in the tower. Might be a stretch, but it was worth a try. Which was the sentence that used to be on the company license plates and paychecks until everyone forgot what it meant and pressure was brought to bear on Nick to change it. Actually, come to think about it, they did not start in the tower. They started out in papermaking, and Nick's grandfather had no grand thoughts about their hiring, only needing warm bodies, so probably nobody really knows where all that other came from. It was Nick's father who asked him to move to the tower. That's right. At least that's the story. Part of it, anyway. Martha and Mary sat in the perfect light of the slanted window, still bent over, working, wearing the Detroit Tiger caps, Martha's on straight over her shoulder-length white mane. Mary's on backward. The Tiger Cap had been their baby, their big project years ago. It was their big ticket item, and until it got farmed out to a sub by some salesman who was no longer there anymore. And now, Mr. Drood had died, the last customer. Mr. Drood had ordered his funeral cowboy cards from Martha and Mary for a long, long time. Nick nodded to them. They acknowledged his presence by holding their spit, not using the coffee can on the floor between their feet. He went to the window and leaned way back, as one was wont to do in the presence of the angled glass. Nick strained his back and began to hurt down by his waist, his lower back. He thought about coming back another day. The M's were tough, and it wouldn't get any easier, so he had to close down the tower. "We won't eat, we won't drink, we'll crap on the floor and piss." That's what he expected them to say. "Nicky, come sit down." "What?" He straightened, really feeling it in the lower regions. He walked over to them. "Sit," said Martha, or perhaps Mary. He didn't see any lips move. Nick looked around for a chair. He sat on the floor, not being able to see them way up on the other side of the table, but he saw their red high-top tennis shoes and their Folgers spittoon. There was no uniform at 3B1K, but everyone was supposed to wear red tennis shoes of some kind, supposed to make work fun. That was the common thinking of the Depression era, when times were tough, starved to death, or you had to pull someone out of a burning building. Having the money to buy the more expensive colored shoes was a sign of prosperity, like a shined car in the driveway. "We know about old man Drood," one of them said. "Oh boy," he thought. He watched long lines of spit. They both began to talk excitedly. "We've been anticipating this day," said one. "As you might imagine." "Yes," he said, pinching his butt to sit up higher, straining his neck, looking around for another chair. "What about POD?" they said together and giggled. Nick leaned back on his hands and crossed his legs out straight. He listened to them talk about print-on-demand, self-publishing, desktop publishing, blogging, social media marketing tools. "We would like to be in one of your more modern buildings with the vending machines on the ground and a view of the golf course." "The ninth tee is nice," said Nick. "Yes. That's what we've heard." "That's the news from Newtown, where all the police and soldiers are thugs, all the Democrats and journalists are cowards, and all the Homeland Security, COINTELPRO, lone gunmen are about average." And that just about wraps up another episode of the New American Dream Radio Show. We thank you for joining us tonight and every night, every Thursday night. And we hope you'll be back next week, right here, Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. And remember, it's a listener-supported station, and they put on a lot of great shows. And so head on over there, make a donation, or buy one of their promotional items. I'd like to thank our wonderful guests tonight. And thank you, Mike, and good night.
You betcha, Chuck. Yes, thank you to Richard Flamer, Jim Fetzer, and Susan Lindauer. And also credit and thanks to James Tracy. Next week, we will welcome our guests, Anthony Reese and Julius Alafong and Larry Pinkney. To get the archives of the show from February 2011, go to the show.newamericandream.info. And as always, we apologize for our mistakes and plan to make fewer mistakes next week. to contact the show, either Chuck or me or any of our guests, write to me at nwestiowa@gmail.com. And as always, we wish to acknowledge the work of South Dakota stone artisan Borglum Borglumson as he works to make over Mount Rushmore, put the real face of American history up there in stone. Lee Harvey Oswald, Sirhan Sirhan, Mark David Chapman, and James Earl Ray. You can follow that ongoing project at looserock.com, rollingstones.com, and jackrubyrubyridge.com. To help support the show, please purchase one of our Tom Jefferson Rolling in His Grave Handy Campfire Rotisseries for the hobo in your family, or get one of our family-sized Obamaville Tom Jefferson Rotisseries for the busy family on the move from town to town, woods to woods, made in Korea. And so, good night to my friends, Chuck and Lorraine. Stay warm down there. And good night, Mrs. Calabash. Good night, Todd Beamer. Good night, Mark Bingham. Good night, Daniel Lewin. Good night, Ken Lay. Good night, Timothy McVeigh. Good night, Emily Parker. Good night, Ben Wheeler. Good night, Crystal Campbell. Good night, Nancy Lanza. Good night, James Foley and Stephen Sotla. Good night, Charlie Hebdo. Good night, Reverend Pinckney. Good night, Muhammad Atta. And good night, Barbara Olson, wherever you are.
Imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try. No hell below us, above us, only sky. Imagine all the people living for today. Imagine there's no countries. It isn't hard to do. Nothing to kill or die for, and no religion too. Imagine all the people living life in peace. You may say I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one. I hope someday you'll join us and the world will be as one.